The Adversary, Old Scratch, The Lord of Lies, Dark Hoary Host of the Netherworld. He's got many names, but I think you can guess who we're talking about.
Could it be Satan?
Right. With more than 1,000 movies and TV shows and countless literary and artistic versions, it might be easy to think of him as a fictional character. But to many Americans, Satan is a real and present threat, not just to our day-to-day lives, but to our eternal disposition. Perhaps you're the kind of person who thinks this has little impact on you, or that people who believe in the literal existence of the devil are out of touch with reality. Recently, Jennifer Senior at New York Magazine interviewed American Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, but here's an excerpt presented for you as a dramatic reading, and I think it says a lot about the relevance of Satan in our real everyday lives.
Monster Dog.
Well, whatever you think of the opinion, Justice Kennedy is now the Thurgood Marshall of gay rights. I don't know how, by your lights, that's going to be regarded in 50 years.
I don't know either. And frankly, I don't care. Maybe the world is spinning toward a wider acceptance of homosexual rights, and here's Scalia standing athwart it, at least standing athwart it as a constitutional entitlement. But I've never been a custodian of my legacy. When I'm dead and gone, I'll either be sublimely happy or terribly unhappy.
You believe in heaven and hell?
Oh, of course I do. Don't you believe in heaven and hell?
No.
Oh, my.
Does that mean I'm not going?
Unfortunately not.
Wait, to heaven or hell?
It doesn't mean you're not going to hell just because you don't believe in it. That's Catholic doctrine. Everyone's going to one place or the other.
But you don't have to be a Catholic to get into heaven. Or believe in it?
Of course not.
Oh, so you don't know where I'm going. Though, thank God.
No, I don't know where you're going. I don't even know whether Judas Iscariot is in hell. I mean, that's what the Pope meant when he said, "Who am I to judge?" He may have recanted and had severe penance just before he died. Who knows?
Can we just talk about your drafting process?
I even believe in the devil.
You do?
Of course. He's a real person. Hey, come on. That's standard Catholic doctrine. Every Catholic believes that.
Every Catholic believes this? There's a wide variety of Catholics out there.
If you are faithful to Catholic dogma, that is certainly a large part of it.
Have you seen evidence of the devil lately?
You know, it's curious. In the Gospels, the devil is doing all sorts of things. He's making pigs run off cliffs. He's possessing people and whatnot. And that doesn't happen very much anymore.
No.
It's because he's smart.
So what's he doing now?
What he's doing now is getting people not to believe in him or in God. He's much more successful that way.
That has really painful implications for atheists. Are you sure that's the devil's work?
I didn't say that atheists are the devil's work.
Well, you're saying the devil is persuading people to not believe in God. Couldn't there be other reasons to not believe?
Well, there certainly can be other reasons, but it certainly favors the devil's desires. I mean, come on. That's the explanation for why there's not demonic possession all over the place. That always puzzled me. What happened to the devil? You know? Used to be all over the place. Used to be all over the New Testament.
Right.
So what happened to him?
He just got wilier.
Yeah. He got wilier.
Isn't it terribly frightening to believe in the devil?
You're looking at me as though I'm weird. My God, you are so out of touch with most of America, most of which believes in the devil. I mean, Jesus Christ believed in the devil. It's in the Gospels. You travel in circles that are so removed from mainstream America that you are appalled that anybody would believe in the devil. Most of mankind has believed in the devil for all of history. Many, many more intelligent people than you or me have believed in the devil.
I hope you weren't sensing contempt for me. It wasn't your belief that surprised me as so much as how boldly you expressed it.
I was offended. I was offended by that. I really was.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk. I'm your host, Blake Smith. Today, I present an unusual interview about a monster who, whether you believe in his literal existence or not, impacts your life on a daily basis. Millions of people around the world and throughout history have believed that there's a dark force, a dark and powerful entity, working against the powers of good in the world. Fundamentalists believe that the Bible is the literal and infallible word of God, and that the villain in that tale is a real and potent enemy of the world. In much the same way that they rail against evolution, they rail against Satan and satanic forces too. There's a kind of logic error called a tautology, which goes like this. The Bible's literally true. How do you know? Because the Bible says it's true. But here's a demonstrable fact. The Bible has changed over time, and it's a complicated work written by many people in many different times. And what I find interesting is that as it has changed, so has the content. The Bible evolves, and its interpretation evolves. You don't have to go back thousands of years to see this. Merely look back into the 1800s and how the Bible was interpreted to support slavery. The purpose of this episode is not to infuriate Christians or to cause atheists to gloat, nor to help encourage people to question their faith. I just want to examine this villainous character who keeps being presented as the orchestrator of all kinds of evil in the world, because I think, if we're honest with ourselves, we'll find that in the end, it doesn't take a supernatural boogeyman to cause all the evil in the world. We have that dark capacity all by ourselves.
Monster Talk.
Monster Talk's proud to welcome back Robert M. Price. You'll likely remember Bob from our Cthulhu episode, which so far is our second most popular episode ever, just behind our Ancient Aliens episode. In addition to his Lovecraftian scholarship, Bob's also a noted biblical scholar and the author of many books on biblical topics, as well as the popular podcast The Bible Geek. So, Bob, welcome back to Monster Talk.
Well, it's great to be here and to be monstrous again.
So I'm asking you here today to talk about one of the most well-known villains in Western civilization, the devil. But I think we need to figure out who we mean by the devil, because there seems to be way more stories about him than just those in the Christian Bible, and he's recognized as a villain in both Islam and Judaism. So who is the devil?
Well, who is he and who was he are two very different questions. The way it's understood now, at least in, you know, literal supernaturalist orthodox Christian thought, and I suppose Islamic and Orthodox Jewish as well, the idea is that Satan, which means the adversary, began as Lucifer, the light bearer, the morning star, and that he was the highest of the angel princes or archangels, and that he was proud of his greatness and decided he could do a better job running the show than God could, and staged a palace revolution with a third of the angels. He lost this bid and was cast down to somewhere. Now, here opinion divides. Is he supposed to be in hell, which general folklore imagines, but the Bible never says, or is he in one of the lower concentric heavens that the ancients believed in? That's stated, at least strongly implied, for instance, in the Epistle to the Ephesians, when it refers to him as the Prince of the Power of the Air, and also in the Book of Jubilees, a non-canonical work. But at any rate, he's supposed to be a fallen angel who is trying to get revenge on God by ruining his creation and the human race. In the Quran, there's a bit more to the story, which has, as far as I know, has kind of dropped out of the standard Christian account, though there's nothing particularly inimical to traditional Christian theology in it. The motive for the revolution was that when God created Adam as a flesh and blood being, he summoned all of the angels to bow down before him, and Satan and his compatriots thought this was insane. He bowed down to this homunculus. Not a chance. God must have lost his mind. We've got to take over. And then that's why. And then why is he so against humanity? Well, jealousy. And he's trying to prove that God was wrong and he was right, that humans are unworthy of this attention from God. So you almost never hear of this anymore, but that's, I think, the full version of the legend. But it's based on various components that have been melded together to create a new origin of Satan. It appears in the in ancient Israel that there was this character known as the Satan, since, again, it was not a proper name, just means ha-satanas, Satan, that is, and it means the Satan, the adversary, implying, on the one hand, a kind of a chief of sting operations, and on the other, an accuser, like an attorney. And the point of this is that the Satan was a servant of God. He was one of the sons of God who would periodically gather, as in the first chapter of Job. And whereas the others were all appointed the heads of the various nations of the earth, his special function was to patrol the earth, looking for hypocrites, basically, and the unworthy, because he didn't want to see God made a laughing stock. As in Job, he says, well, God says to him, well, if you've been patrolling the earth, surely you've come across my servant Job. I'm pretty proud of him. He's perfect in righteousness. He serves me, and so on. And the Satan says, don't be naive. With all the fringe benefits you give this guy, he would be a fool not to worship you. Now, what are you saying? And the Satan says, well, let's try a little experiment. Take away everything you've given him, and we'll see where his heart really is. And so God says to him, well, all right, do your worst, but just don't harm him personally. So there's an ambush by a bunch of marauders who kill his cattle and steal everything he's got, and there's an earthquake, and his seven children die, and it's horrific, and his wife let's see, I've got that detail wrong. She, at some point, she says, why don't you just end it all? Curse God and have him kill you. No, I'm not going to do that. We've accepted God's gifts when we like them. He's brought these things our way. Are we going to start refusing delivery? It's up to him. I'm happy either way. And she says, you're crazy. Well, then the sons of God meet again, and God says, well, you moved me to destroy old Job without cause, but at least you see that I was right. He is faithful to me. And Satan says, well, or again, the Satan says, well, you stopped me from really doing this experiment. Let me afflict him physically, and you'll see how fast he turns. Okay, and this time Job is stricken with plagues. He's covered with boils, and he's sitting in the wreckage of his house, and his three friends come over, and they tell him, look, obviously you've sinned greatly. God doesn't punish the innocent. And he's, look, I'm sorry to disappoint you guys, but I am innocent. God is harassing me. It's fascinating. But the idea is that the Satan is not an opponent of God. He's zealous for God's reputation. And the two other instances of this, he I guess it's Second Chronicles, is it first? I forget. Where's the source document, First Samuel, had God test David by suggesting he take a census of Israel. And that was bad because, according to the holy war idea, you didn't trust human resources. You just sort of fanatically went into battle because God was on your side. Well, he's showing the lack of faith by seeing what the resources are. Well, God then punishes him. But in the retelling of it, it says that the Satan tempted David to do this. Well, that's not inconsistent. The idea is that the writer figured, well, of course, the Satan is the servant of God who handles these matters, and he wants to see where David's heart really is. Then there's another one in the prophet Zechariah. There's a vision where God is about to accept a man named Joshua to be the new high priest, and the Satan confronts him and says, "No, this guy. Look at his track record. His priestly garments are stained. So he's got something wrong with him." And then the angel of the Lord shows up and rebukes him and says, "Well, you're right, but we're going to purify him and then give him the crown." So in every case where he appears, it's just three, but that's really enough to set the tone. He's God's right-hand man in some ways. He's trying to weed out the fakes. Now, how did we get the idea that he is God's enemy? The name means adversary, but originally he was the adversary of sinners and hypocrites. How did he become what he's called in 2 Enoch, Sathanael, the enemy of Elohim, the enemy of God? Well, that scene, he never appears as such in the Old Testament. The Satan has nothing to do with the serpent in Eden. That's a whole different thing. Nor is he the fallen being Halal, the son of the dawn in Isaiah 14, nor is he the fallen king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28. These passages are always quoted out of context as if they were about Satan, but they're not, as you can easily see by just reading them in context. Well, don't see between the Testaments is the Babylonian exile. Well, it does happen like in 2 Kings. What the missing piece is, the Jews, the Jewish leaders, the priests and others, were held captive there for about 50 years, they and their descendants. And toward the end of that time, the Persian Empire overcame the Babylonians, and the Persians were Zoroastrians. They believed in this apocalyptic sort of monotheistic religion. And apparently, a lot of their ideas appeal to the Jewish priests who learned about them, and they didn't persecute them. They got along fine. And among the ideas were resurrection of the dead for the final judgment, a supernatural messianic figure who would raise the dead, the division of history into deterministic predestined periods of battles of good and evil, complex belief in loads of different angels, especially the notion of an evil anti-god. In Zoroastrianism, it's called Ahriman Ahriman or Angramanu. Well, he was almost the equal of God and his opposite, and the history of good and evil fighting throughout history is the two sides, and God versus Ahriman, Ahura Mazda versus Ahriman, and every act a human performs is a blow struck on one side or the other, hence it's all a great moral battle. Well, apparently, Jewish thinkers kind of liked this idea because the notion of God had become increasingly rationalized and moralized. The holiness of God had originally simply meant the uncanny otherness of God. God was really beyond human good and evil, like we would be beyond the rules we set for our pets, not to wet the carpet and all that. We're not too worried about that. Well, so now thinking of God as morally righteous, redefining holiness, now you had some explaining to do. Where could evil have come from if there is just one God? Well, the Zoroastrians said, well, there's kind of two gods. One of them is evil. That means the good God is not all-powerful, though he will win in the end. He would eradicate evil right now if he could, but he's not unopposed. And that sounded pretty good to Jewish thinkers who said, all right, maybe somebody else is the author of evil. Though they wanted to be strict monotheists by that time, so they couldn't have a second god, so they said, well, how about if there was an angel who fell and became God's enemy? That didn't quite solve the philosophical problem, but that does seem to be where it came from. In other words, they reinterpreted Satan to be Ahriman, the evil enemy of the good God, and that starts appearing in various works that didn't make it into the biblical canon. The Book of Jubilees, 1st and 2nd Enoch, the life of Adam and Eve, the apocalypse of Moses, and various others. And that's in place by the time of the New Testament. And I'll end this in just a second, mercifully, but the New Testament still usually depicts Satan as a kind of one who puts the anointed of God through their paces to test them. Not evil, just trying to make sure people are what they're cracked up to be, which is why he takes Jesus out into the desert to test him. If you're the Son of God, how about this? This is a pretty good idea, isn't it? What do you think? And Jesus sees through it and won't do it. Satan's not trying to get him to do the wrong thing. He's just trying to see if he will do the wrong thing. Jesus accuses Peter of being Satan, get behind me, Satan, because he's trying to persuade him not to go to the cross. Well, that's the whole idea. Will Jesus give in to this test? And he doesn't. At the Last Supper, he warns the disciples they're going to all fall away and run away, and he says, Satan has demanded his right to test you all like wheat from the chaff. Yeah, that's what he does. That's his job on God's behalf. Then in the book of Revelation, we have a bit of this idea that Satan is a fallen angel, but this battle in heaven occurs at the end of the age, and Satan is called the accuser of the brethren. Well, yeah, that's the whole idea. He's doing a good service to God that way. Satan, even in the New Testament, appears only as an evil character only when he's been combined with other originally distinct beings. One of them is Ahriman. He's not named in the New Testament, but that's in the background. Secondly, when he's combined with Beelzebul, the prince of demons, in Mark chapter 3, that's a whole separate character. That originally was some sort of Phoenician god. It didn't really have anything to do with the biblical Satan. And the third one is in the book of Revelation, where they conflate Satan with Leviathan, the seven-headed chaos dragon that's mentioned several times in the Old Testament, in this ancient creation myth, where God, like Marduk and Indra and various other deities, created the earth out of the carcass of a dragon that he slew. So when Satan is combined with the seven-headed serpent, then he's evil, but there's no unanimity of thought even in the New Testament, and more often than not, he's a good guy there. So you really have a post-biblical development into Satan, the evil one.
Well, just to let you know, you've tore through about my first five questions, almost in exactly the order I was going to ask them. This is amazing. So I was going to ask one, which was, how did Satan get so many nicknames? But I think what you just said is that after the development of the Bible. So when would that have been after? So by the time of Jesus, he was still considered to be a tempter, or at least by the time the Gospels were written.
Yeah, and it's not absolutely clear that he's more than that, except in the Beelzebul controversy, or in the King James, the Beelzebub, who's a different god, where they say Jesus is casting out demons by magic. He's bound the power of Beelzebul, the prince of demons, which exorcists actually did. Jesus goes on to defend the idea, as I read it. He said, well, you can't despoil a man of his goods unless you bind him first. And this is the rationale for appealing to the power of the prince of the demons to order around his subordinates so they no longer infest and possess people. Well, so it's not absolutely clear there that Satan is the bad guy, but that's about as close as you come in the Gospels.
Wow. So how much of Satan's history actually comes from other popular fiction or folklore or I'm not sure what else to call it. What do you call the sort of belief developments that happen after the canonical religious prescription?
Well, the tricky part is that it happens in a kind of a gap between the Old and New Testaments. It's a product of folk religious belief, so I guess you could say folklore, but it just like the Assumption of the Virgin Mary became, the perpetual virginity of Mary was apparently popular Catholic piety that eventually became official doctrine. That seems to be what happened here, that there were different theories, for instance, as to who the demons were. Of course, it was like an ancient diagnostic category. They didn't know anything about abnormal psychology, and especially when people had epileptic seizures, they said, oh, a demon has seized. In fact, that's what epilepsy means, to be seized upon in Greek. So who were these demons? And various people said, well, they must be ghosts of the dead who haven't gone on to paradise. And others said, no, God just created some bodiless creatures at the dawn of creation, and they would like to have physical warmth, so they try to, they're squatters in other people's bodies. Others said, no, they're the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men, whose trysting led to the flood of Noah in Genesis 6. Then another one was, well, maybe they are the sons of God back in Genesis 6. That was originally a story about why a group called the Rephaim or the Anakim in Canaan were so tall. Most people were shrimpy, and these people were over 6 feet. And what made them that way? And they kind of figured, well, they must have had divine ancestors. They must be descended from demigods. And so you had Genesis 6, 1, 2, and 4 outside of the flood story originally, which said, well, these people are the result of the mating of the sons of God, the lesser gods that God has appointed in charge of the nations, mating with mortal women.
And this is the Nephilim?
Which kind of looks like the Hebrew word for fallen, and so the legend may have grown as an attempt, as often happens in the Old Testament, to explain a name nobody understood anymore. So they're the fallen ones. But originally, there's nothing bad about this. It's just like Hercules is so strong because he's a demigod, God, divine father, a mortal mother, and it was no problem. But as Judaism crept closer and closer to monotheism, they couldn't have sons of God. There couldn't be 70 subordinate beings in charge of the other nations, so they demoted them to angels, created beings, and now the idea that they should mate with mortal women just seemed pagan and evil, and so the story had to be reinterpreted as the fall of the angels. Now, that's still not Satan, but Satan gets tied in with this in the Book of Jubilees and First Enoch and so forth, where we're told that after Satan rebelled against God, he recruited the sons of God. And there are various versions of this in the few books we still have from this period. So it's like a folkloric embellishment of what is what you do see surfacing in the Old Testament here and there, especially when people no longer quite understood what the original point was, and patched some of these stories together. And once you bring in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 about some kind of angel or Adam figure or something, and you just ignore the original context, well, suddenly you've got a whole biography of Satan here, and a lot of it is taken for granted by the New Testament writers. First John refers to Cain being a murderer. Well, where'd this come from? Why is he such a bad seed? Well, because Eve was impregnated by Satan. And First John says that he was of the evil one, and that's why he murdered his brother. And in Second Corinthians, it says that Eve was seduced by Satan, and this is made explicit in the life of Adam and Eve and other of these works. So a lot of these are so offensive to any kind of theology today that they get reinterpreted again to take the barb out of the tail of it.
Well, so I think growing up in a very fundamentalist family, I had always been told that demons were all fallen angels. And I don't think that's actually scriptural. That just seems to have come from somewhere. Like, does that seem, I mean, do you know of any scriptural origin for that idea?
No, it's not unlikely that that's what the gospel writers thought, but they don't really say so. And one of the most important exorcism story is that of the Gadarene or Gerasene demoniac in Mark 5, I think it is, where it implies that the legion of demons infesting this guy are the ghosts of the dead in the cemetery that he lives in, which is why he lives there, and why when Jesus threatens to kick him out, they don't want to leave the area. Why is that? Well, because they're the ghosts of the dead there. And so there's a big hint that not everybody in the Christian orbit believed that they were fallen angels. The idea of the principalities and powers, that there are demonic, the heavenly forces of wickedness, as Ephesians says, for instance, that is part of the fall of the sons of God idea. And this is a profound myth in the true Bultmannian sense. That is a myth that that explains and articulates a group's understanding of their position in the world. People realize that you couldn't have chaos and anarchy, the war of all against all. It was better to stem the chaos with government, but everybody knows government is wicked, as we're seeing more and more every day. And so it may be like the mafia running Chicago, but it's better than just endless violence in the streets. And so they had this sophisticated myth that the nations are ruled by fallen angels, the principalities and powers, and one day God will end that rule and rule directly, and then the millennium will arrive. But until then, even this is better than nothing. And so the fallen angels were understood to be these evil powers behind the human thrones of the nations, not necessarily these pesky demons that caused epileptic fits and scenes like in The Exorcist. That's not quite the same thing, and yet there is some reason to think these guys were believed to be fallen angels. I believe it's in the Book of Jubilees where it says that Mastema, who's apparently Satan, is after his bid to unseat God, he is tossed down to one of the lower heavens, and most of his minions are going to be cast into the nether world of darkness, a feature drawn right out of Hesiod in Greek mythology. But Mastema says, well, look, I am to be the scourge of sinners, right? So why don't you give me 10% of the fallen angels to do my dirty work? And that would appear to be the possessing demon. So that link is made, but that doesn't seem even to be the original point of the fall. Even that seems to be an embellishment, combining different myths.
Well, at least nobody believes that these powers are controlling people today.
there of course are loads.
No, I'm joking. Of course, I grew up with the was it Hal Lindsey?
And that
sort of mentality. So like in the 1980s, I was really aware of these sort of vast, dark, satanic conspiracies which are supposed to be at play in America. And it turns out that a lot of this, especially some of these satanic cults and stories about children being murdered and stuff, were actually coming out of recovered memory type behavior, which has now been shown to be able to make people believe really amazingly unlikely or implausible or impossible sort of things. And then some of it seemed to be just a really imaginative but paranoid people, I'm going to say, making up or confabulating. But in that same time period, I heard people say that Jimmy Carter was the Antichrist, Bill Clinton was the Antichrist. I hear people saying Barack Obama is the Antichrist. So, you know, and then there's this sort of satanic apocalyptic literature that's super popular, selling lots and lots of books. But how's that whole satanic apocalypse coming along? I mean, is that working out okay?
Well, I don't know who is still saying that, because I'm in less close touch with people that know about it than I used to be. But there were various people that, at least three of them I can think of, that claimed to have been, back in the late 70s, satanic high priests and all of that. And Mike Warnicki was one of them. And he was just a con man. He was simply making it up. And there were others that appeared to be more paranoids and believed it, but there was no grounds for it. And then that was compounded by this recovered memory nonsense, which is really just like a redo of the Salem witch trials, that these incompetent shrinks would say, are you sure you don't remember your dad sacrificing your baby sister in the basement? Well, literally.
Right.
And they just—it was all leading the witness, just planting these memories. I can picture it. I guess I do remember it. And so you had utterly dumbfounded parents finding themselves in jail for this. And none of it ever happened. As to the idea that the Illuminati are around and they're going to take over, that of course has had a vogue and still does on the extremes of both the left and the right. But whether they literally demonize that and tied in with Satan as these Jack Chick type fundamentalists did, I don't know how popular that is.
Obama's Antichrist is a pretty powerful idea right now. I just, in fact, right before this interview, I happened to be reading an article, and one of the pop-up ads, I guess because of my research, was a really graphic image of a giant Barack Obama in front of an audience with FEMA people pointing guns at the audience, and click here for this important video to save your family in the future, the dark future that's coming. And so I clicked on it, and it was all about why we need to be hoarding our food for the coming dark times that are coming. And it was all, you know, it fed into the same idea. And there seems to be, in the conspiracy world, there seems to be kind of an interesting split between the people who believe in the Illuminati, the people who believe in reptilian aliens,
and
the people who believe in a satanic overlord, or sort of a dark power, spiritual power being behind all the bad things that are happening. So,
well, the unfortunate thing about this is that there is a point to this stuff if it's not understood in a literal and paranoid way, like the notion of the principalities and powers. I think this is quite profound. It just doesn't have anything to do with the supernatural. It's a recognition of things that it took 20th century sociology to understand, that there are supra-individual forces politically, culturally, economically, multinational corporations, agencies of the government, religions, anything you want to pick, any institution that it was created by humans long ago but now have taken on a power of their own to the point where there's no single human face, no concerned individual could hope to change these things. So these are, I think, aptly symbolized, and maybe even irreplaceably symbolized, by the demonic principalities and powers. If you reduce it to the omen and think that it's literal devils, that trivializes it, but there's a powerful. I think I heard Jerry Brown say this once, probably the only thing he ever said I agreed with, but that there really is a point about this. I mean, if you're saying, you know, why can't we get those fat cats to just repent? It's not a question of that. There's an institutional inertia or institutional racism. Right? You can get all kinds of individuals to stop being racist, but if there's a structure to it that people have vested interests in, this goes way beyond what any individual could do. Well, likewise, if you like when fundamentalists say, "Oh, the universal product code is the mark of the beast" or something, that seems kind of crazy, and it is because they're taking it literally. They're saying, "Oh, is this the prediction? Oh boy, let's match A with B." That's crazy, but think of all this surveillance by the NSA and the IRS, all this stuff going on that I never thought was going on. This, you suddenly see, is what these symbols were about. When you see a shocking overreach by the authorities, then these myths start to click in. And it doesn't mean there's a literal antichrist. There's not. In fact, that would be less relevant. The idea is that Hitler was the Antichrist, Mussolini, Stalin, these guys were the Antichrist, because it's a mythic archetype that people unfortunately live into and embody. And I do think Obama is a dangerous megalomaniac who is shredding the Constitution. And I can see why superstitious folks say he's literally the Antichrist. Well, there is no literal Antichrist, but the symbol is handy to make us say, wait a minute, this guy is getting too big for his britches. We could be in trouble here. No matter who you think, I mean, if you didn't like Bush, the utility of the symbol would still apply, right? It's always a question mark to be raised beside leaders. And so that's the utility of myth. It's not just scientifically true or false. It's a sure. Jungian kind of a thing.
Well, it also works for corporations in that they have now achieved a kind of personhood legally, but they
don't have
souls, and they don't have, in the more literal sense, they don't have empathy, and they don't have regret so much, you know.
That's right. Exactly.
So it's certainly a workable metaphor, but I think I'm far too – well, you live in the South too, but I mean it's just I run into way more people who believe this literally in supernatural sense than I do who consider it in the metaphorical sense where it might be useful.
Yeah, I will admit that these people may have – they may also, like Tillich said about naive literalism, they may also be getting the real point of it, even though they happen to believe in implausible literal applications of it. I think that people are nowadays very rightly suspicious of government, no matter who's in charge, and if they also happen to believe there's going to be a literal antichrist and a rapture, well, really, who cares? That they might be right about their suspicions of the government anyway.
This is going to be the most controversial Mustard Talk ever, because I think I've avoided religion as much as possible and politics almost completely, so this should be interesting.
Yeah, I know people that like my writing, the minute they hear I'm a Republican, they think that I'm an idiot savant, that I happen to know some. I'm like the Rain Man, that it's self-evident that no intelligent person could be politically conservative, and in return, I think it seems very clear to me that dogmatic political liberalism is a fact-proof faith position. So it kind of is a mirror image, I guess.
Well, I think the issue, when just again, one of the reasons I try to keep politics off is just because I think dogma itself is the problem, and that the whole political system seems to have made the idea of compromise like a bad word, and like people are not working together towards helping America or the world for that matter. They're just looking for their own personal gain, and that there's way too much selfishness and not enough altruism.
So that's
one of the reasons I just tend to avoid it, because I don't have any answers.
I agree.
You really covered a lot of what I wanted to ask you about really neatly without me having to ask questions. so the devil changes over time and becomes instead of being someone who's working towards God's mission, becomes this character, at least within Christianity, and I guess to some extent Islam as well, where he is the bad guy who's blamed for everything. How does that work? I mean, is it dangerous for people to ascribe blame to this spiritual force instead of taking responsibility for their own actions? Or do people even do that, do you think?
Well, I know I've heard jokes like the old Flip Wilson thing, the devil made me do it, and all that, but I have never met anybody that, I've certainly never met any kind of devout fundamentalist that was trying to slide out of responsibility. I regret the, I think, the intellectual errors of fundamentalism of any kind, but I, my experience has been that most of these people of any religion who take it so seriously really are concerned about their moral integrity. I mean, there's hypocrites everywhere, but my experience has been that the devil is almost superfluous to their belief. He's a fifth wheel because they do not underestimate the frailty of human nature. And like when the Epistle of James says, where do we get all these disputes and this strife? You expect him to say, well, of course, could it be Satan? But he doesn't say that. He says, well, of course, it's your own desires. It's your own nature, as it obviously is. So the fundamentalists do happen to believe in this satanic mastermind, but in my experience, most of them, it almost would make no difference to their belief if that wasn't a part of it, because they know, oh yeah, I have the potential for sin. I'm tempted by my own weaknesses and desires, and they're a little too tough on themselves.
Well, I know that more than one humorist I've read has made the comment about Satan that I don't have time, nor am I needed to make up all these terrible ideas. People do it themselves.
Yeah. And that's an important Christian realization. Once I was talking to a professor at Gordon Conwell Seminary right after the Jonestown horror, and he said, don't you think that's evidence of Satan in the world today? And I said, I wish it were. That's optimistic. If there was one supernatural terrorist we could somehow get rid of, everything would be okay, but there isn't. This is in human nature. This shows the depths to which human beings can too easily sink. So the Satan thing, if they took it seriously, I think would be inimical to their theology.
When we think about how people consider Satan today, the image of Satan and our stories of hell and of how Satan got there, so much of it seems to be sort of stuck, pulled straight out of Dante and out of Milton. And I wonder, this is completely fanciful in a sense, but Dante, you know, he populated some of the lowest pits of hell with people who were still alive. You know, so like their souls had left their body and now they were being controlled by demons and still walking the earth alive, even though their souls were in hell being punished. And I know he was making a joke, but it also seems like a wonderful metaphor for people who are psychopaths who don't have what we would consider to be like the sort of emotional responses we would expect from a normal person.
And
I always thought it was a nice metaphor for that, even though that's not what he had in mind when he made those jokes. But so how much of that does, I mean, it seems like most of what we think about the appearance of Satan comes from medieval and Renaissance art, but not from the Bible and just our ideas of hell, or that hell, as I read the Bible, was really not very well described.
That's right. There's Tartaros that First Peter mentions, and it's the name and the idea seem to come right out of Hesiod and other Greek writers. Tartaros was the pit of darkness where Uranus had imprisoned the giants and some of the titans, monstrous offspring that he couldn't unleash on the earth, and they're in chains there under the in the caverns of darkness, just like First Peter says that the fallen angels are. I think it's First Peter, maybe Second Peter. And that comes right from there. Or Hades, which is usually, like, of course, the word hell is an English word, not a bad translation for Sheol, the netherworld of the dead in the Old Testament. But the idea of a fiery pit of torment, that goes Hades, the Greek word used in the Gospels, that could mean the place of the dead without necessarily being a place of torment, as when Jesus says that Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin, who spurned his preaching despite miracles, they will not rise to heaven. They will be brought down to Hades. Well, that's kind of a recollection of Isaiah 14. The king of Babylon will find himself waking up on the dung heap in Sheol. But Gehenna is the one where it's a fiery hell. And that's a very old idea in the Old Testament. It's a place, it means the valley of the sons of Hinnom. And this was a place of valley right at the base of Mount Zion. And according to their mythic cosmology, they believed that that Mount Zion with a temple on top was the gateway to heaven where Jehovah lived, and that Tophet or Gehenna down below was an opening to the fiery netherworld of Molech, a god who received human sacrifices, infant sacrifices. So there was this subterranean fiery realm, and the innocent went there. That's the difference. It wasn't a place of post-mortem punishment. But eventually, it's combined with Tartarus and so on. But it's not clear in too many of the places in the New Testament where hell is mentioned that they're thinking of a place where all the wicked will wind up. In the clearest places in Revelation where it says those who have taken the mark of the beast to save their hide will rue it, because they will be thrown into the lake of fire, and the smoke of their torment rises day and night forever before the Lamb and his throne. But that's special treatment given to these people that knuckled under to the beast. It doesn't say whether all the unrighteous are going to join them there, which is kind of an important thing. If you're trying to compile this jigsaw puzzle of theology out of little postage stamps in the Bible, and in Matthew 25, the sheep and the goats judgment, the people that didn't help the least of the Son of Man's brethren are going into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Well, who then are the goats? Are they the devil and his angels? Are we even talking about human beings at all? It's not that clear. The places in Matthew where it says that people will be thrown into the fiery furnace where they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth, these have been added by Matthew again and again from a phrase in the Q document that didn't mean quite that originally. When the end comes and Gentiles are welcomed into the kingdom, and Jews, the proper heirs of the kingdom, are shocked to see it, and these unrighteous Jews will be excluded. They will weep and gnash their teeth in anguish. It's not about what's going to happen in hell. Matthew applies it to that. There's very little said. There is nothing in any epistle attributed to Paul about anybody going to hell. The dead that are wicked just don't rise. So it's really a mixed bag, and it's not at all clear.
I was thinking about the parable of Lazarus and the rich man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only place I'm aware of where you've got a picture of someone in hell. Also, not only are they being tormented, but also able to look up and see heaven and what they're missing out on.
Mm. Yeah, he says, I am in agony in this pit of torment. And he figures his wicked brothers, or at least his rich brothers, they seem to equate the two in Luke, they will die and come to the same sad fate. There were hells of torment in ancient Jewish and early Christian thought as well, and it's interesting, this doesn't entail a final judgment. This is yet another version of it. This is more like what people think of today. You die and go to heaven or hell. Did they also think that they would be recalled to their bodies one day for a superfluous second judgment, rubber stamping the one that landed them in heaven or hell in the first place? That sounds like somebody is trying to stitch together disparate ideas in the Bible, but That certainly, or Jesus in the same gospel tells the repentant thief, today you'll be with me in paradise. Nothing about Jesus going to the right hand of God. They're just both righteous, and they're going to go to heaven when they die shortly. So it doesn't quite fit in with the rest of the scenario, but there is a post-mortem suffering passage. It is there. It's just that not all of them seem to agree.
No, right, right. And the different writers,
yeah,
different
yeah.
times. So, should we be afraid of the devil, Robert?
I don't think so. Only paranoids are, even in terms of Orthodox Christianity. If you're afraid of the devil, you're not being a very good Christian. Because First John says, "He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world."
I had that argument with the. I'm not going to say who, some family members of mine, that I had some family members who were very, very frightened of satanic power, very, very frightened of demons. And my reading was, if you were a believer in Christ, there was no reason to be afraid. And so I never understood all the fear at all. I never understood the fear. It was so strange.
I can see concern if you really did believe that. And again, this could be secular. If you think, our country's going to hell in a handbasket,
it was
made about that.
This was supernatural fear. This was the oogie boogie fear.
Were they afraid that the satanic conspiracy was going to usher in the Great Tribulation, or just that things were going to be awful bad?
Yeah, I think they were afraid that. That maybe a demon could possess them, that people they knew might be under the influence or control of Satan, that there's very real dark spiritual influence in the world that directly impacted them in their life.
Yeah, I would just, if I were still a believer in this, I would tell such people that I think they're not trusting in Christ, this is morbid preoccupation akin to the person that's afraid every day they're going to die of some germ or whatever, that anything could, or like Christians that don't believe in eternal security and say, well, gee, it's possible I might fall away and lose my faith. What would happen then? Anything's possible, but that's not the life of faith you say you signed on for. Isn't the hope of glory Christ in you? Isn't Christ powerful where you are weak? And if you trust in Christ, what do you have to worry about? It seems to me that's they have a poor faith in Christ if they're that worried.
Yeah, they may have also just had some perpetual worry situation going on.
Yeah, yeah. But it's awful to have it magnified and compounded with superstitious fear. And I'm the last one to say that if you're a Christian, you're automatically superstitious. I think you've got pre-scientific beliefs in some ways, but there are a lot of sound, healthy-minded people that hold these beliefs. That, however, is just neurotic morbidity, and I hope people like that can slough off that burden.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, it's interesting. I mean, because again, I've typically tried to avoid religion and politics on the show, but Satan is such a big monster, and he's had such a big influence on Western culture, in movies, in modern times, and in the ancient times, and directly tied to the witch trials, and directly tied to some of the interpretations of religion in early America, definitely tied to a lot of things that happened after The Exorcist and the sort of cultural impact that had. So it really felt like we had to touch on this. I mean, he's a topic that has to be covered.
Yeah, there is evil in the world, whatever you think about it metaphysically. I mean, there's certainly stuff happening. There's certainly people that it's appropriate to use that word for, even if it's just a metaphor. It's unfortunate to get distracted from that by thinking the real issue is whether there's this fallen angel lurking around like Lex Luthor somewhere. That's the problem. You can't do anything about. It's possible you might do something about your own character or your own circumstances, and that surely should be the place to concentrate.
I have a question for you, and that's, is the devil's greatest trick convincing us he's not real, or is it the recipe for delicious chocolate cake?
I say I go with a cake.
Yeah, the cake's pretty awesome.
This whole thing is circular. Like once a pastor who's a friend of mine was saying that the Hammer films directed by Terrence Fisher were important. He knew they weren't literally true, but this idea that, you know, the vampire's greatest strength is that no one believes in him and all that. And I said, well, yeah, but there aren't any vampires. Like, what point are you trying to make? It's a circular thing. Is there any reason to believe in the devil? Because if not, you could say, well, the strength of the little green men in the moon is that nobody knows they're there. Well, how do you know they're there? I mean, if there was such an entity, I guess it might come in handy, but there's certainly no reason to take that seriously.
Yeah, but I do like this film.
Oh, yeah, yeah, me too, me too.
I want to say thank you again for spending almost another hour with us. And I do try to ask all my guests, and I think we asked you before on the Cthulhu episode, it may have changed, it may not have, but what's your favorite monster?
I guess it would have to be the Frankenstein monster.
That's a good monster.
Yeah, I love him. My daughter Victoria and I watched 30 or so monster movies during October as a countdown to Halloween, and we watched Frankenstein, Bride of, Son of, Ghost of, House of, they meet David Costello, Evil of Frankenstein, and so on and so on, and most of the other Universals. They're just better and better every time I see them, and it's tough to beat the undying monster.
Yeah, and also, you know, man's terrible hubris at creating something he can't control.
So. Now I know how it feels to be God.
I know. I can't get tired of those films. What I just realized, maybe last year, I think for the first time I sat down and watched Son of Frankenstein and didn't realize how much the Mel Brooks Young Frankenstein was really just a riff on Son of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But it made me want to go watch that film again and enjoy it even more. So just fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and this has been a great discussion.
Oh, yeah. Any old time. It's loads of fun.
All right. Have a good evening.
Monster Talk.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. I'm your host, Blake Smith, and today you heard me interview biblical scholar Robert M. Price about the history of the devil. You can find links to Bob's books and podcasts in our show notes at monstertalk.org. The dramatic reading at the beginning was performed by Brian Thompson and Carrie Poppy. Carrie can be heard on the podcast, Oh No, It's Ross and Carrie, and Brian can be seen aimlessly wandering the streets of Los Angeles. I promise you, the views and opinions expressed on Monster Talk are not necessarily those of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. I'm still working to get a live Monster Talk Google Hangout set up, so please follow me on Twitter at Dr. Atlantis and check out our Facebook group, where you'll meet a variety of people who will passionately discuss cryptids, monsters, and adorable kittens with you. Hey, it's Facebook. I sometimes ask for donations here to help with our transcript project, but I'd like to ask you instead to donate to the Red Cross or any reliable aid organization working to alleviate the horrible tragedy going on in the Philippines right now. With more than 10,000 people killed by the largest typhoon in recorded history, speedy aid is vital before disease and starvation kill even more. Don't just think about it. If you can afford a coffee or a phone application, you could give that up for a day or two and use that money to make a difference over there. Salamat. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for listening.
Skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Who was interviewing him?
Oh, Connie Chung.